We're well into the second half of 2021 now, so it's a good time to look back, to reflect on what's happened in the year so far, and then to look forward, what's ahead. And boy, what an extraordinary year it's been. Property values across our capital cities have experienced double-digit growth already this year. And despite the COVID concerns we're experiencing, there's plenty more growth to come. Clearly, buyers are out in force. Owner-occupiers, investors, first-home buyers. And that's happening at a time when the available supply is struggling to keep up. And of course, this keeps pushing prices higher. The surge in property values has caused the property bears to go back into their caves. They're hibernating, you don't hear that much anymore, do you? And our major banks have done an about-face and are generally forecasting up to 30% rises in property values for this cycle. And they're suggesting this strong growth going to continue for some time yet. And as we look back, the economic Armageddon predicted by some didn't eventuate, did it? We didn't fall off those cliffs that were meant to litter our path, did we? I mean, most podcasts and commentary concentrate on the micro factors, you know, what's happening on the ground in our property markets, and I do that twice a week. I also like to regularly get together with property commentator Pete Wargent in these big picture podcasts to look at the macroeconomic factors affecting our economy and our property markets to help give you some more clarity about what's ahead, what the future holds, so you can make better investment and business decisions. So welcome to today's podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropol, who specialise in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
Property markets don't operate in isolation. So to be successful, to be a strategic investor, it's important to take a telescopic view, a big picture view of the macroeconomic factors affecting not just Australia's economy, but the world economy. So to help us understand what's ahead for us, each month we have these big picture podcast chats with Pete Wargent, a lifelong student of and commentator about our economy. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Michael. Good to be back.
Now, Pete, since we last spoke a month or so ago, Australia's economic recovery, it's continued to unfold. More jobs have been created. Our property markets keep surging. So maybe let's start with property initially, and then we can look at the economy. But all those dire predictions of our housing markets, the doomsayers of a year ago, when, sure, things were uncertain in 2020 with COVID, they haven't come to fruition. The markets turned in October last year, and they've gone gangbusters ever since.
Yes. I mean, if you look at year-on-year prices, very strong gains in Sydney, 15%, Brisbane, 13%, Adelaide, 14%. I think that's an interesting thing. I mean, there's actually been even stronger growth in Hobart, Darwin, Canberra. Regional markets have done, 17%, 18%. So it's not just been confined to one city. It's genuinely right across the board. And I think that's potentially quite a rational response, really, to the lowest mortgage rates we've ever seen. And it's just seen a broad-based uplift in dwelling values and right across the country this time.
Well, it started off with the lower end of the market picking up and regional Australia picking up, but now all the capital cities other than Perth have exhibited double-digit growth this year alone. And the higher end, the more affluent areas, the more expensive areas of the market are performing very strongly.
Yeah, exactly that. Now, I suppose there would potentially be some parts of the market that haven't really participated. And I think that's, quite concentrated. I think it's just really those CBD city markets with the high-rise towers, which were probably struggling a bit anyway. But without the international students and tourists around, vacancy rates have been pretty high. Some investors have sold up. But it's actually just shifted a lot of the rental demand into the sort of more spacious properties. Yeah, I mean, if anything, it's actually sort of put pressure on the rental markets elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much across the country, just probably those inner city units have struggled a little bit.
Sure. With regard to rental demand, that's started to pick up now too. Vacancy rates are falling, rents are going up. But when you look at the Melbourne rental vacancy figures or the Sydney vacancy figures. They're skewed, aren't they? Because in some areas, as you say, like the CBD apartment markets, rental vacancies are still high. But in other areas, and particularly for houses, it's actually hard to find accommodation.
If you'd have said back at the start of this pandemic, when international borders and travel became difficult, that we'd be talking about the lowest rental vacancy rates on record, well, you wouldn't have thought it would make much sense. And yet that's how it's played out. So it shows it's difficult to predict sometimes how these trends might play out. Yeah, lots of pressure. I mean, some housing markets have seen rents really rocketing higher. So that will actually start to feed into inflation gradually. I think the inflation indexes are largely sort of weighted towards Sydney and Melbourne. And the unit rents have just held things down a bit. So nothing much to worry about from an inflation perspective. But if you're a renter in the housing market, you've probably seen your rents heading up.
Moving forward, though, I can see the pace of growth slowing. I'm not suggesting property values are going to fall. In fact, I think based on the fundamentals we're seeing, there's at least another 10% in the big capital city property markets this year, Pete.
Yeah, I think the pace of growth, I mean, I wrote a couple of pieces for Livewire Market, so that was my base case. I think the rapid pace of growth might cool in the second half of 2021, but you know, we're still talking about rising prices, just not as quickly as they have been. I think one of the big trends at the moment is that there's a shift now towards investors coming into the market. There's been a big jump in investor applications. So we'll start to see more investors active, I think, in the second half. Investors were sitting on their hands for a while. I think partly they're just waiting to see how the pandemic might play out. But clearly now it's a vaccinable disease. No deaths in Australia really this year. So I think people are starting to think, well, if I can borrow at 2 or 3%, this might be a good time to add an investment property to the portfolio.
Sure, and that's what happens in each cycle. A whole new generation of investors come in, but let's hope they listen to people like you and me and don't make the mistakes others have made in previous cycles and get caught with the wrong property at the end of the cycle. As we look at the news that's happened since our last chat about this a month ago, there were statistics coming in again showing that Australia's households just keep getting richer and richer. Household wealth grew more in the last year, Pete, than it did in the preceding 3 years combined.
Yeah, so Credit Suisse put out these annual reports. So, I mean, there's different ways to measure it. The ABS measures household wealth in Australia in Australian dollars, and Credit Suisse does a global report, which is in US dollars. A huge uplift for Australia this year, but that's partly foreign exchange. But whichever way you look at it, Australia is pretty much top of the tree, certainly in terms of median household wealth. The average adult in Australia is as wealthy as anywhere in the world. Now, we've talked about before, sometimes if you look at the average household wealth, that can be skewed by some of the countries with the super wealthy, like Switzerland or the US. But median household wealth in Australia has done phenomenally well, a reflection of high rates of property ownership. So the government doesn't own much of the stock. Superannuation has been a big success story for Australia. The stock market's buoyant. So, I mean, it's happy days, really. And the Bank for International Settlements separately did its most recent report, and it showed that the government stimulus has been very effective on Australia in fueling excess household savings, and Australia right at the top of the tree of all the countries again. So there's a lot of pent-up cash on household balance sheets there that can fuel a consumption boom and probably a continuation of the housing boom as well.
Well, household wealth is related to ownership of property, ownership of homes, and also superannuation. And Credit Suisse are suggesting that 1 in 10 Australians are technically millionaires. Now, I know some people did suffer during the COVID era of the last year or two, but in general, more of Australians have become wealthy and the rich have become richer. In fact, to March this year, household wealth increased 15.3%. That's the fastest rate since the middle of the mining construction boom over a decade ago.
Yeah, so the number of US dollar millionaires in Australia went from 1.4 to 1.8 million. So it's about 1 in 10 adults now is a US dollar millionaire. I mean, it's interesting, you know, we used to think when I was growing up, a millionaire was somebody who was super rich. Of course, now the term has become a bit meaningless because most people will get there, you know, simply through home ownership, contributing to their super. I guess you'd probably say wealthy these days, in inverted commas, is probably, say, $5 to $10 million US rather than $1 million. So they might need to have a look at how they measure that in the future. But nevertheless, Australia, in terms of millionaire density, again, very, very high. I think there's probably some countries like Monaco where they just don't have the data. We'll probably be higher there. Or is Monaco a principality? I can never remember. But
yeah,
whichever way you look at it, Australia has fared remarkably well over the past 20 years.
Look, you're right. Being a millionaire doesn't count for much anymore. Pete, when I was young, I wanted to be a millionaire by the age of 30. Being a millionaire was a big thing. By the way, I didn't actually make it by the age of 30, but that was almost 40 years ago. That was a lot of money in those days. But if we're looking at money, the Reserve Bank and interest rates, well, they kept the cash rate at 0.1% again. We knew that. That wasn't going to change. It's the lowest point for 8 months. But Governor Philip Lowe keeps telling us the economy is doing much better than it previously forecast. And every time he says that, it ignites speculation that interest rates may increase sooner than predicted.
This has been a fascinating turn of events. So we spent 5 years there where the Reserve Bank was going through this tug of war with the government over who was going to actually provide the stimulus to get unemployment down and wages rising. The Reserve Bank was reticent to cut rates too quickly because of household debt and housing prices. It's funny how things have played out. It took a global pandemic to see a change in the direction of the leadership. Now, all of that's gone out the window. Reserve Bank's gone to zero interest rates, quantitative easing, a yield target on 3-year government bonds. So they've really pushed hard. Now, interestingly, now there's definitely been a change of narrative. And again, this week, the Reserve Bank continues with QE. It's going to continue for the rest of this year. But all of the commentators have been saying, oh, we might see interest rate hikes next year or the year after. The Reserve Bank just keeps pushing back and pushing back. So it's hard to imagine a more dovish position than where Phil Lowe is coming from. He's saying the Reserve Bank will not increase interest rates to cool the housing market. If measures are needed, it will be they'll be taken by APRA. They want to see wages price growth come back in nominal terms. They want to see inflation sustainably back at 2 to 3%, and that could well mean inflation running over 3% for a period, because we've been under 2 for so long. So people have jumped the gun a bit here and said the economy's doing really well, we might need a rate hike. It's not coming. So maybe in a couple of years we might see things starting to tighten a bit, but at the moment, forget it. It's low mortgage rates for the next couple of years at least.
Having said that, fixed rates for longer terms, 3, 4, 5 years, they've started to creep up, but just a fraction.
So I think that the cycle has bottomed. So the Reserve Bank, I think we talked about on the last Big Picture podcast, they had this term funding facility in place, so banks could tap that line to provide ultra-cheap mortgage rates. Well, that's been wound back now. We won't see fixed rates go any lower than they are now, is my best guess, unless something extraordinary happens. But again, you've got to look at it in the context of, as we said, it's the Big Picture podcast. You know, you can still find fixed rates under 2%. So if the odd mortgage rate here or there has gone up 5 or 10 basis points, it doesn't really move the needle. You might see some banks tightening the assessment rates on mortgages, which is a de facto tightening. So, yeah, I think, you know, we've probably seen the bottom of the cycle, but, you know, that's a long way from seeing interest rates rising significantly. I suspect that's probably 2 or 3 years away.
Yeah, they're very, very different things. Having said that, people are taking advantage of the low interest rates, and the latest housing figures showed that the value of new home lending almost doubled over the last year since May last year. It increased 4.9% over the month of May, and owner-occupiers are still there. First home buyers are tapering off a bit, but from really strong highs, of course, and investors are starting to get into the market, Pete.
Yeah, so year on year, housing finance was up about 95%. Of course, that was coming from an unusual nadir because, the economy was effectively shut a year ago in May. Yeah, I mean, record highs in any case, about $32 billion or so for housing finance. I think the interesting trend is that owner-occupier lending has been extra strong in New South Wales and Victoria, but now it's the investors starting to come back. The cycle is largely driven to begin with by the first home buyers and upgraders, but now it's transitioning towards investors. So I think that'll be the big trend over the next 12 months is how quickly do investors come back, because the regulators will be just keen to watch that and make sure it doesn't overheat again like it did 4 or 5 years ago. So that'll be one to watch.
A couple of things come out of that too. When you say that there was $32 billion worth of housing finance approvals in the month of May, that excludes refinancing, which means over $1 billion worth of money is going into our property markets every day, Pete.
Yeah, and as you said, there's a bit of nuance to it because, you know, when you've got construction loans, for example, you know, not all of it goes into the established housing market. So I do like to break out what's happening just on established homes. Now, interesting trend there is that the lower interest rates have actually seen the average loan size for established properties has jumped about, what, 68,000 over the past year. So that's 13%. So if you look at what's happening to housing prices, yep, near enough 13%. So it does all kind of make sense when you drill into the figures. I think those construction loans will actually start to drop away now because the home builder stimulus is winding back and a lot of those homes will get built. There's some unusual stuff going on in the housing finance figures, but if you drill into it, it kind of makes sense and it's fairly rational.
Just like first home buyer numbers are down, but the value of first home buyer lending is up because that reflects the rising prices, just like you were saying with investors.
Yeah, I mean, first home buyer numbers are down a bit, but when you look at it, you know, 15,000 in a month, that's as high as we've ever seen. I mean, they went very slightly higher during the Rudd stimulus in 2009, but you know, when you're talking in the context of numbers, typically, what, for 10 years, they were running at near enough half of that. So very, very elevated and still continuing with the first home loan deposit scheme. So I think a lot of first home buyers are finding, well, it's just as cheap to be an owner of property as it is to be a renter. So why not get in?
Sure. We've both spoken about rent vesting before, but at the moment, owning your own home can make quite a lot of financial sense. And that messes up the argument from all those people who say housing is unaffordable. We've never had as many first home buyers. So housing is affordable, maybe not right in the centre of Sydney or Melbourne, but there are still opportunities.
Yeah, and in fact, if you look at the numbers, New South Wales and Victoria have been very big drivers of the increase in first home buyer commitments. So the challenge for first home buyers is always the deposit. And obviously the first home loan deposit scheme has closed that deposit gap to some degree. So it will become harder again at some point in the next couple of years for first home buyers. And maybe that's when they start looking at rent vesting again. So I think we'll see that home ownership rates have actually increased over the past year or two. So that's the first time we could say that probably since the Rudd days. So, you know, that's a good thing. It fuels some consumption as well as those people have to renovate or sort of furnish their new properties. And you know, it's always good to see young people getting onto the housing ladder.
And as you say, it has lots of spin-off effects in the economy with the furnishings and the other things you've got to buy when you buy a house. Now, just for those who don't understand, the Rudd government made similar stimulus moves after the global financial crisis to get our economy going. So that's what you've been referring to a couple of times. 2009.
Yes, and it's something to bear in mind, you know, because people often tell me, oh, well, you need to compare the housing market downturn of the 1880s and so on. Very different dynamics these days. And we've seen this very clearly over the past year. When the economy gets into a real hole, then not only will the Reserve Bank step in with extraordinary monetary policy measures, the government will just, you know, switch on the fiscal stimulus. So you can't really compare what happened, you know, 140 years ago to the housing markets of today. I mean, for one thing, the housing stock is no longer slums in the rocks. You know, we're talking about some of the biggest housing in the world in Australia. But the whole dynamics of financial markets are totally different these days. And that's even changed a lot since the financial crisis. These days, reserve central banks and governments are very quick to switch on the stimulus so that the downturns are less severe.
Well, that's meant that our economy has continued bounding along. The economic Armageddon that was predicted by some of those doomsayers proved nothing more than hysterical paranoia. Those fiscal cliffs that we spoke about last year, not suggesting they were going to happen, but we were giving our thoughts about them, they didn't eventuate. The deferred housing loans, they were all repaid. Remember, there was an argument a while ago about when fixed interest rates would come off and people would have to start paying higher rates. Unemployment was going to be another cliff after JobKeeper ended in March. None of that came to fruition.
No, I mean, one of the things you learn if you follow markets is there's always something on the horizon. As you said, at one stage it was interest-only loans resetting. Then it was going to be all these loan deferrals were going to turn bad. There's always something that comes onto the radar. The funny thing about it is that the more people talk about these risks, paradoxically, the less likely they are to happen because remedies are found. It's quite often, the things you don't see coming are the really big issues, like, for example, a pandemic. But if you look at where things are heading now, I mean, job vacancies, we've never seen anything like it. You know, there's never been so many jobs being created as there are right now, not even during the mining boom years. So, yeah, it's an interesting time. I think probably a year ago things were looking a bit shaky, but it's been an amazing rebound for Australia.
Well, the jobless rate fell to below its pre-pandemic levels of 5.1%, with creation of over 115,000 jobs in May. And we know that the underutilization rate and the participation rate are all pointing in the right direction as well. And with international borders, I think they're going to remain shut for a bit longer than we'd all hoped. That means foreign labour is not going to come in as much, which is going to fuel skill shortages. So I can see unemployment rate with possibly even a 4 in front of it moving forward.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the latest ABS jobs vacancy figures to May, there were 362,500 job vacancies. Now, previously we were running at, 150? We got up to 200 in 2017. We've never seen numbers like this. Now, if you take that at face value, all those jobs get filled. The unemployment rate could be 2.5%. I don't think we'll get to there because some of the jobs will be hard to fill. For example, in hospitality, they're just finding it really difficult to fill roles now because there just aren't the people coming in. But as you said, I mean, at the very least, we should see unemployment heading towards 4%. And wages will rise as employers struggle to find appropriate staff.
Sure. Well, businesses are doing well. Many businesses are. And the only way they're going to get staff is pinch them from other industries and push up wages. Another statistic that came out over the last month's been new car sales. There are 110,664 new cars sold in June alone, the most in 2 years. Now, I know young people were supposed to favour public transport ride sharing like Uber and Ola and Didi, but then along came the COVID health crisis, and I think we're back to buying cars again and not wanting to go on public transport.
Yeah, I mean, history shows if you put cash in consumers' pockets, they do tend to spend it. And housing has been a big beneficiary over the past year. And it seems that new cars, which were always popular, are making a comeback. I did wonder whether people might be a bit more reticent because of the shift towards electric vehicles and so on. But it seems to be, no, people just like to have a new vehicle.
Yeah, it's a nice toy. I think the other thing was there was a government incentive for businesses to purchase cars before the end of the financial year. So I know a number of people who hopped in there to be able to write off their car very quickly.
You're right. You can get a pull forward when you get those tax incentives and maybe things will drop off again come July figures. But yeah, I mean, generally speaking, yeah, as the BIS said, that no country has had the excess savings across households that Australia has, Australia and New Zealand right at the top. So, yeah, all of that stimulus that hit the mark and it's done exactly what it was intended to do.
And in the last month, there were some more population figures that came out that showed Australia's population increased by 136,300 people in 2020. Of course, this was the slowest population growth since ABS records began in 82. There were babies born, close to 300,000 babies born, but that was the fewest births in 13 years, down 4% or so on the previous year. Sure, Australians were dying, but not as many. So fewer babies, less deaths, and nobody coming from overseas. So probably was more interesting when I dug into the figures, Pete, was the movement of people and where they were going and interstate migration. And there was quite a shift. Queensland was the beneficiary of interstate migration.
Yeah, you beat me to it. I think, yeah, the absolute numbers well down, obviously, because the net international immigration has basically stopped. But yeah, the internal movements were very different. So, I mean, the biggest impact has been in Victoria, because in 2017, as you remember, population growth in Victoria was phenomenal. People were coming from overseas, they were coming from interstate. There was 154,000 in 2017 growth in Victoria. In calendar year 2020, the number was under 1,000. It's basically zero, 0% growth. And in fact, since September, the number's even slightly negative. Clearly, Victoria had more than 20 weeks of lockdowns. A lot of people took the opportunity to get out and go to those lifestyle markets, Gold Coast, Sunshine Coast, Brisbane. So interestingly, Queensland's population growth at 1.1%, 58,000, was pretty solid. And the interstate migration to Queensland was over 30,000. We haven't seen that in 15 years since the mining boom years. So, you can see this in Queensland, just driving around, Victorian license plates everywhere, rental vacancies extremely tight in some of those coastal markets. So, yeah, it's not so much the headline numbers that are interesting this year. It's more the internal shifts. But this will change when the borders reopen. So it's probably a temporary blip.
Sure. And what it doesn't show is the internal changes within the state. So I'd think if we had a look at the figures and able to, you'd see fewer people would have been moving from regional Victoria to the Big Smoke. Why would you do that? The jobs weren't there. You'd be locked down anyway. And that's one of the reasons that regional property markets performed well, because it wasn't just people from the Big Smoke moving to regional areas. People from regional areas, as they left university, as they went out looking for jobs or opportunities, you wouldn't come to Melbourne or Sydney.
Yeah, we do always have a tendency to look at what's happening right now and try and sort of extrapolate it. But I suspect this is a unique period in Australia's history. I think there will be some debates about what the right level of population growth is, because we've seen this has really tightened up the labour market, and there'll be some push for potentially a slower rate of immigration going forward. But my guess is when the borders reopen, the demand to live in Australia is going to be huge. So, governments can rarely resist that. They do like the sugar hit to GDP growth, and particularly if we can get young migrants in, it tends to be a net benefit.
Well, the last thing I'd like to chat about today is the intergenerational report, which actually didn't get as much publicity this time round as I remember it getting when it came out 4 years ago, or 5 years ago, I think it was this time around, because what happens is the government brings out these intergenerational reports, which is supposed to show what Australia is going to look like in 40 years' time if the current policy settings remain the same. It looks at population trends, ageing, government spending, and projects them forward to see what impact they're going to have on government finances. And it showed that Australia's population is expected to age and become smaller than expected.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the thing with the intergenerational report, it's a bit of a theoretical exercise, because nobody can really say what the world will look like in 40 years' time. Projecting forward, Australia will grow to just under 39 million by 2061, so lower than previously projected. But as I say, current year figures are a bit unusual, and it may well be that those figures are way off. It's a bit of a political document too, so it can be used to justify policies going forward. So they, talking about an aging population in Australia and potentially an impact on the budget, as there's a dependency ratio change down the track. I think potentially, there's a bit of a message here that we're going to see a shift back towards an immigration program focused on younger people going forward. But you can't really predict what's going to happen in 40 years. If you actually look at the predictions that have been made over all the intergenerational reports, population growth always exceeds the forecasts, because governments, they can't resist pumping up the numbers. The labour force in Australia has increased by 40% since 2003. So it's been a massive increase over the past two decades. I suspect the next two will be very similar.
Well, that's an interesting thought, because it's taken, I don't know, 280 years or 200 years, whatever, to get to 25.5 million people. In the next 40 years, we're going to add another 14, 15 million people. That creates some exciting opportunities.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's always a double-edged sword, isn't it? When you're sitting in traffic driving from Noosa to Brisbane, you always think, oh, surely we need to deal with immigration, you know, and find better ways to build infrastructure and so on. But of course, you know, the benefits of immigration for the economy are huge. So, and obviously as a migrant myself, you know, you tend to look at these things slightly differently. Now, Australia is in a very good position in terms of being an attractive place to come to. I think that potentially, once things get back to normal, in inverted commas, I suspect immigration will be pretty high again.
Well, just looking at the big picture then for this month, a lot of positive news. Unfortunately, there have been some health issues this month. There have been some lockdowns this month, which will affect local economies, particularly in New South Wales, when the next round of figures come out. But overall, lots more green shoots, lots more positive than negative news, Pete.
Yeah, again, I mean, with each passing month and quarter, the economic rebound seems to get better. And I suspect that when the figures for Q3 come out, particularly, you know, GDP growth has been solid. But if you actually look at nominal GDP growth, then it will be very, very strong. I mean, we've got a huge boom in commodity prices. The economy is rebounding very quickly. I hesitate to say boom time conditions, but we're not far off. So long may it continue.
That would be great. Now, I know you regularly commentate on the economy, not just on this podcast and on Property Update, but your own podcast, your own blog. So if people want to get more of your thoughts, where do they find you?
Pete Wargent Blogspot is my daily blog, so you can get my daily thoughts and complaints there. And, PeteWargent.com is where you can find out more about me, or Twitter, or just Google me. You'll track me down.
And of course, I'll leave a link in the show notes. And if people are interested in the stock market, which is one of your areas of expertise, you've got a podcast related to that as well.
Yeah, Low Rates, High Returns podcast with Stephen Moriarty. Once a week, we put out a podcast there. We're slightly different tack. We talk about the stock market trends and how you can generate an income from stocks.
And I'd be encouraging people to listen to that. Thank you very much. Catch up with you again next month, Pete.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
I hope you got some benefit from my chat with Pete, and I've got another way of you benefiting, learning a bit more about how to take advantage of this property cycle. As my way of saying thank you for subscribing to this podcast, go to podcastbonus.com.au. I'll leave a link in the show notes, podcastbonus.com.au, and there you can pick up a bunch of reports and ebooks to add to your success library. I hope through my discussion with Pete, oh, by the way, in a moment I'm going to share with you my mindset message, where I'm going to talk about the big difference between the rich and the average Australian. And it's probably not what you think. Sure, they got more money, but it's more than that. But what I was about to say was that I hope by now you're realizing that we are in an unusual property cycle. In my mind, this is a once-in-a-generation property boom. In fact, I haven't seen a property boom like this for a number of generations. But my question to you is, do you know how to take advantage of the property cycle? Sure, the worst is over, but I still believe the best is yet to come. It's times like this that you need to get a plan to help you take advantage of the cycle. Because as the cycle moves on, not all properties are going to perform the same, and other properties are going to not be the right ones, the ones you don't want to hold at the end of this property cycle. If you want some guidance, some direction, some certainty, you can trust my team at Metropole to help you outperform the average property investor and give your family the financial freedom they deserve. Go to metropole.com.au, find out about our range of services. You'll see we keep winning awards, we keep doing the right thing by our clients, and it's put us in the position to be trusted by more property investors than anyone else in Australia. metropole.com.au will offer you a time-tested system of growing your wealth, and we'll be by your side. More than evening the odds, will give you a considerable advantage. I look forward to being part of your wealth creation journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In my mindset message today, I'd like to have a chat about the big difference between the rich and the average Australian. So do you want to know the big secret, why the rich are richer? Well, many people have studied this topic. Many have written about it. Napoleon Hill wrote that classic Think and Grow Rich almost a century ago. Tom Corley studied The Rich and the Poor for 5 years and wrote his first book, Rich Habits. Then together we wrote Rich Habits, Poor Habits. By the way, there's a new edition of it out. It's just come out and you can get it. Go to a Property Update and have a look at the website there in the bookstore and get the latest copy of Rich Habits, Poor Habits. Now, we found that many things separate the rich and the poor. Contrary to what the poor want to believe, it's not only luck, it's not fate. Tom Corley found that the poor prefer to believe the rich have got some advantage that they haven't got. This is the type of thinking that enables the poor to remain in their situation without taking any responsibility. Now, I'm not judging rich or poor people as good or bad. What I'm saying is if you want to become richer, if you want to become amongst the wealthy people, whether you choose property or your business or whatever, you've got to understand this big difference I'm about to share with you, why the rich keep getting richer. Sure, luck does play a part in your life, but lucky people do many proactive things to put themselves in the position to take advantage of luck when it strikes. But here's the big difference. The poor, and in fact the average Australian, focuses on survival. They focus on instant gratification. They don't tend to think beyond the moment. However, the very rich think and plan very far into the future, 5 years, 10 years, or even 20 years. The poor think about the moment. They think about the next pay period that they're getting. They think about the end of the week. The middle class, they're hoping to make it through the month. But the rich, they're planning a year out or several years out. They're planning into their future. Of course, multimillionaires, decamillionaires plan out decades or two in the future. So if you want more money, if you want more freedom in life, you're going to have to learn about delayed gratification. Successful people have got the ability to work hard to accomplish a goal which won't be achieved for a long time. You've heard me say it before. Do the easy things now and you'll have a hard life later. Do the hard things now and you'll have an easier life later. Successful people possess this sort of higher patience and an aptitude to postpone the enjoyment of their work. That's because they understand that long-term success takes a lot of skills that unsuccessful people, they lack or they haven't experienced. Now, these attributes comprise proper planning for the upcoming challenges, associating with the right people, self-confidence, tolerance. On the other hand, unsuccessful people, by and large, they can't see the forest for the trees. Learning to delay gratification rather than seeking immediate satisfaction, in my mind, is essential for success. And that's just as important when it comes to property investing. It takes time to allow the power of leverage and compounding to grow a large enough asset base for you in residential properties. While it takes time to change ingrained habits and approaches to life, things that you've probably been taught since childhood, the good news is it is entirely doable. Start with small alterations to your thought patterns. Acknowledge some of the poor habits that you've got, things that tend to lead to immediate gratification. Remember, if it comes too quickly, chances are you're going to lose it just as readily. All good things take time. You've heard me say it before. Please excuse me if I repeat it again. Warren Buffett wisely said, wealth is the transfer of money from the impatient to the patient. I hope you enjoyed today's Big Picture podcast, the podcast Pete Borchardt and I run once a month to look at the world from a telescopic view rather than the microscopic view. And if you got some benefit from it, if it's giving you some insights, why not tell somebody else about the Michael Yardley podcast? Help me in my aim to make as many people as financially fluent as possible. If you'd like to catch me in between these twice weekly podcasts, just look for me on social media, Michael Yardley. You'll find me in most places. But I have a special place where every day I leave some tips, I leave some charts, I leave some commentary that I don't leave elsewhere. And that's my private Facebook group. So why not join my private Facebook group? To keep up to date, go to Facebook, look for the Property Update private Facebook group. Hey, I'll leave a link in the show notes, and I'd love to be part of your wealth creation journey. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropol, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropol to help you?